Okay, so welcome back to KDD. Today we will finish up the frequent patterns lecture, and we will get into the first parts of the classification chapter. First question before we really start, are there any questions regarding last week's lecture? I don't think so. Okay, then just a quick summary. We already talked about how to get to frequent item sets. We also talked about how to get association rules from frequent item sets quickly at the end last time. And now we have to talk about evaluation of our patterns, because it's not always said that any frequent item set or association rule we find is really meaningful or interesting. Of course, we make sure that they satisfy our support threshold, they satisfy our thresholds in general. However, there can still be misleading association rules. For example, if you talk about an association rule, basketball leads to eating cereal. And we know that our support is 40%, and we have 66.7% trueness to that. Then this might, and this is just an example, of course, be misleading if the overall percentage of students eating cereal is 75%. Because then playing basketball actually leads to eating less cereal than not playing basketball. So even an association rule satisfying our thresholds might be misleading. In this case, it's just an example again. The rule basketball leads to eating no cereal actually would be more accurate, because now we know that 33.3% of persons eat no cereal if they play basketball, while 25% eat cereal if they are not playing basketball. This might happen if we have negative correlation. To measure something like that, we can apply an interestingness measure. I will help her out for a second. The best way to get in is up there. is called LIFT. LIFT tries to find dependent or correlated events. If we have a value of 1 in the LIFT measurement, then we are independent. Below 1, we are negatively correlated. Let's take our example back to that. We have our amount of values. We have playing basketball and eating cereals at 2,000 entries, no cereal and playing basketball at 1,000 values, and so on and so on. I think you should all be already be aware how to read this table. And now we can compute our LIFT measurement by applying the amount, well, the percentage of people playing basketball and eating cereal, so 2,000 divided through the total count, 5,000, through the independent events, eating cereal and playing basketball. If both would be independent, of course, we would get to 1. However, in this case, for the case playing basketball and eating cereal, we end up with 0.89. And for the case of playing basketball and not eating cereal, we end up above 1, so 1.33, which is, as we discussed earlier, more accurate for our case, because we are above 1. This is just an example for interestingness measures, measurements for frequent patterns. We have a lot more of them. This is just the first page. We have a second page, and we can discuss about some variants in there as well. I do not expect you to have them in mind. It's just for you to be able to look them up later on in any career stage. There are actually even more. The paper where we got this table from is from 2002, so there have been a lot more interestingness measures being proposed since then. However, we have one big problem: how to select the interestingness measure we are interested in. So which are the good interestingness measures? One thing you can use for that is to divide the list of interestingness measurements into null invariant and null variant measurements. A null transaction or a null invariant measurement is a measurement is null invariant if we are not influenced by null transactions. A null transaction is a transaction that does not contain any item that we want to examine. So for example, a typical null transaction might be an empty purchase in a transaction history, because there's no item set within that that we want to examine. Or if we have if we have something like, again, a transactional data set with items, 1, 2, 3, and we have A, B, and C in here, C, B in here, and A, D in here. And we want to evaluate A leads to D. Then the second transaction would also be null, a null transaction, because it doesn't contain A and it doesn't contain B. So this is also a null transaction. Especially in large data sets, this might outweigh individual item sets. So for example, again, if you look at a large online store, which has tens of thousands of items for purchase. And you want to talk about different association rules within that online shop. Then, of course, a lot of transactions doesn't contain the items we are looking for. For example, if we are looking for, let's go with a specific football and specific football gloves. What percentage of transactions in an online store actually contain both of them, or actually at least one of them? It's a very small percentage. And if we have a not null invariant measure, so a null variant measurement, these would influence our interestingness measurements to become lower than we wanted to. We already talked about lift. Lift is null invariant because we are not talking about probabilities of null transactions in here. We are just talking about the probabilities in here. So if we have, for example, only 3 transactions that are relevant for us and 10,000 null transactions, of course, the number would get low. However, the numbers down here, and let's say every transaction also contains this, is also getting low. And therefore, Lyft is null invariant. Just as an example. The same is true for chi squared. Chi squared it should already be known from an earlier chapter where we talked about correlation, measurements. In total, we can say that there are a lot of measurements or interesting measures, the same list as here. However, just a small list is null invariant. So confidence, for example, the cosine and Chakar, which is nice to have. In this table, there are also some other measurements, like symmetry under variable permutation. Again, this table is not expected to be known by you in the exam. It's just for you to look it up later on. So do not worry about learning that by heart. It's not expected. Just a small example for the problems of null transaction invariance. If we are talking about a new case where we have coffee and milk drinkers, or coffee with milk and coffee without milk and no coffee with milk and no coffee with milk, milk and no milk and coffee and no coffee. Let's do it this way. We see that different measurements all trying to evaluate our correlation and our frequent patterns come to totally different results, depending on whether they are, whether they are null invariant, here in red, not in red, null invariant, that's the wrong slide. All these measurements are null invariant, this is seen here. And they are actually very good to measure our quality of our things. Also, there is a huge list of there's an analysis of DBLP co-author relationships evaluated with some of the measurements. I will skip that because not expected and time is short. What is expected, and these are the measurements we expect you to use or to be able to use in the exam, are the imbalance ratio and the Kolsinsky measurement. We will talk about both. Are we talking about both? I think we are talking about both in the first exercise of frequent pattern. Why do we want that? So Kolsinsky is in the list in here. I forgot to put it in the real slides. Okay, you will see it in the exercise. Imbalance ratio is trying to find imbalance between two item sets in dual implications. And Kolsinsky is trying to see whether they are neutral or not to each other. If we're taking a look at this table down here. And basically, this should be the same as here. Ah, and here's the Kosinski measurement in here. So shortened calc. We see that these two data sets down here, D5 and D6, have a very high, close to one value at the imbalance ratio. And they have values that differ a lot and that are exactly at 0.5 for Kosinski. Kosinski is telling us that if we are close or at 0.5, we are neutral. So that's good. If you take a look at the imbalance ratio, both are close to one, which is very imbalanced. If we now take a look at D4, we are again exactly at 0.5 for Kosinski. However, we are at 0.0 for imbalance ratio, which are both the best possible values. We are balanced and we are neutral. So for Kosinski, the best measure is 0.5. For imbalance ratio, it's zero, because then there's no imbalance in our data set. We will get into some detail on that again in the exercise, so I will not go further here. But these two are the only measurements next to lift that I would expect you to know in the exam, just as an addition to that. And of course, also, I want you to know how to interpret them. So Kosinski is 0.5, is the best value, and imbalance ratio, 0, is the best one. OK, basically, that's frequent patterns finished. Are there any questions regarding that last chapter? A lot of not relevant for the exam, so I do not expect that many questions, but I still want to ask. OK, then let's get to a new chapter, classification. Ah, before we get to a new chapter, since we now finished frequent patterns, it's time to start the first submission. The first submission will get available at 12 a.m., so in 1.5 hours from now, and will be available until 23rd of June, just before midnight. That's just to make sure nobody misunderstands 0.0 as midnight, because Sturon always shows 0.0.0 for that. You are allowed to build groups of 3 people to submit that. However, you have to create an entry for yourself, or not for yourself, but we are using GitHub Classroom for that, and they will ask you to name your partners in that. So make sure you know your partners if you want to work in groups. You are also allowed to work solo on the project. Okay. And you will be asked to implement a priori and fpgrowth, basically, in that submission. If there are any questions regarding the submission after the submission released, as always, ask them in the student forum. I'm happy to answer them if they after that is released. OK, enough of that reminder. Let's get to classification. Classification. So we now talked about frequent patterns, which is actually the first real application of our lecture. The second, not application, but real method. Let's call it a method. So before that, we always talked about pre-processing and how to handle data to get it ready for a method. Now we talked about the first method, how to find frequent patterns. The next thing is we want to find classes. However, if we are talking about classes, we have to talk about two different kinds of classes. Because within machine learning, we have two kinds of learning. We have supervised learning and we have unsupervised learning. In supervised learning, we know through the training data which classes a tuple should have. For example, if we have a data set of students, we might know, and we want to find the class pass, we might have things like degree program. We might have things like previous grades. And let's go with data science, computer science, IIS, things like that. Let's give them all a pass in here, so I do not prefer any study degree program. And let's say we had previous grades of 2.0 and 1.7, not that relevant. The relevant part is that we know in the training data some students that have passed or haven't passed. Okay? That's supervised learning, that we know that passed class. And we are now able to train a model on that training data, which is able to then predict the class of someone with some specific values. So through the training on these data, it can predict the missing class for a new tuple. That's supervised learning. Unsupervised learning is also possible to get to classes, or to be more precise, to clusters. Unsupervised learning is basically we do not know a class, but we want to find groups that belong to each other, that are close to each other, that might end up with two classes that we can later label as yes and no, or things like that. But basically, clusters do not have a label attached to them. These two differing methods, supervised learning and unsupervised learning, for classes in specific, or classes and clusters in specific, clusters are pretty similar to classes, are the topic of our new next two chapters. This chapter is about supervised learning, so classification. The next chapter is about unsupervised learning, so clustering. And in this chapter, we will also take a look, again, at some basic concepts. There are some additional basic concepts attached to that. We will talk about a few methods of classification, because there are always different methods this general method kind, which are decision tree induction, rule-based classification, and bias classification methods. This is not a full list of classification methods that are possible to do. For example, we can do classification with neural networks as well. However, they are out of the scope of this lecture. We will take a look at these three methods in detail. or again, subtypes of methods, because there are more methods within each of these methods. Then we will talk about how to select the best possible method, very similar to our interestingness measures in frequent patterns. And we will talk about how to combine different measurements to get the best possible model. Because sometimes we want to combine different kinds of classification models. We already talked about the difference between supervised and unsupervised learning, so let's get to prediction problems. In classification, we want to predict the class labels. These class labels are typically categorical. So we have a specific set of allowed classes to be the result of our classification. We use our training set, for example here, to classify a new data set where everything is known besides the missing class. There are two kinds of classification, or rather of attributes we can use for classification, because we can use numerical values that are continuous. In this little training data set, we only have two specific passing grades. However, if we go by grade average, it's possible that there are a lot of different possible grades a student might have. They are nearly continuous because we have every value in previous grades might be between 1.0 and 5.0 or 6.0, depending on which grade system you're using. Just because we do not know, we do not have any training tables, might not tell us, just because we have some very specific values in here, don't prohibit that the tuple we want to predict might not contain another value within our passing grade. That is only possible with numerical prediction, that we can predict the class of a tuple that contains a value that is previously unknown. So we didn't know 2.31 in this case. That's possible. Typical applications of classification, just to finish that up, we might have it for credit or loan approval. That's pretty relevant in these days in Germany because of some laws being unlawful currently regarding to our credit loan approval. A big company in this case that is trying to predict whether a person is worthy of a credit or not, a credit score, if you want to say it this way. This is basically classification. We are using a lot of data to predict how credit worthy each one of you is in here. We might have classification for medical diagnosis. If we take a look at a picture, a doctor might be able to tell us whether a person has cancer or not. However, we always need a very specific picture showing us that exact spot where this cancer might be. It's also possible to get a certain tendency by taking a look at several blood values and things like that in a body to at least have a rough prediction whether he might be tumorous or not. Or in this case, in this example, it's actually about tumor being cancerous, so good or bad. But that's basically the same. We can talk about fraud detection, so if you have a transaction on your credit card, whether it seems to be okay or isn't okay. If you travel to another country, then you might have seen that using your credit card for the first time in that foreign country might lead to the card being declined, because one part of that prediction is it in the same country as it was used before? And that's basically classification. And so on and so on. The classification process, so the process on creating a model and using that model, is a two-step process. I already used this two-step process in my explanation, in my previous explanation, because for the first time we have two phases where we first train a model and then use a model. In frequent patterns, we are just applying our methods to data and implicitly are using our methods. In this case, we have to first train a model on our training data set and then use it for predictions. And we can infinitely reuse our trained model for many more data sets. Once we have trained a model, we can reuse it and so on. It might be good to retrain it at some point, but it's not required by the model. We will get into some detail on that in the exercise and also in the lecture. But basically, we first train a model and then we use it. Of course, part of using the model is also trying to evaluate the trained model. That's also part of a later section in this chapter. So basically, in our two-step model, we have first training data that we put into our classification algorithm, and later we get out some classification rules. And then we use it, we might, and we should, also evaluate our data before we are using it on real data. Then we might have a small subset of our training data, or rather our original data set, our original label data set, shouldn't be part of the training data, to be precise, but that's something we talk about later on as well. And we put these data without the class into our classification rules, and then try to test whether the correct class is predicted. All things we talk about later. But have that in mind, this two-step process, because it will get relevant. It's going to get relevant. Let's do it this way. Any questions about that general process? I think it's pretty basic, so nothing to worry about, but again, I want to ask. If not, we can get to our first method. Decision tree induction. Basically, if we have a training data set, in this case, we have a big training data set with some persons where we know a rough age, a rough income, the student status, and a credit rating, which might itself be result of classification, and a class we want to predict, bias computer. Then we can use the training data set to create a so-called decision tree. A decision tree is basically a tree where we have a root node with a decision. In this case, the decision is, what is the age of a person? If the age is below or equal to 30, we get a next decision. If a person is below 30 and a student, it's predicted, that the class is yes. If age is below 30, or below or equal 30, the person is no student, the class is predicted to be no, and so on. And this decision tree can be induced, so trained, on our training data set by different algorithms. So decision tree induction refers to the process of learning a decision tree based on labeled training data, while decision tree is the result of that decision tree induction. I guess the names of different items within the tree should be known, but let's go through them. We have a root node, we have an internal node, both containing decisions, and we have leaf nodes containing the class labels. And the branches, of course, contain the decisions or the values the decision might have. More interesting is the process of decision tree induction, which is an algorithm. To be precise, it's a greedy algorithm, without backtracking in most cases. Basically, we go from top to down. So we start with the root node, take a look at the different branches. Maybe we are creating new nodes, or if only one class is present, we might also end up with a leaf node. Basically, the process is creating a node, then splitting the attribute, determining a splitting attribute. So, for example, age, or student, or credit rating, which are all attributes of our data set, according to a splitting criterion, which we have to decide through an attribute selection method, which is something we will talk about in some slides, because there are different attribute selection methods to be selected. Then we label n with a splitting criterion, for example, age, ? And depending on the kind of the splitting attribute, we might have multi-way splits. So like with age, we had a three-way split in this case. Three branches get out of that node. But for some attributes, we might only have two, so binary. And also the attribute selection method has something to say about that. We will get to that later on. And for each outcome, we create a partition of the original data set. So only after age is created, within that left branch, we will only have values with age below 30. And this is the partition. So we select the first, second, fourth, first, second, this tuple, and these are the tuples we are taking a look at to create the next iteration. And we have a recursive process. So now, once we have created the partition, we are again trying to create a node, and so on and so on. The stopping criterion in this recursion is that if all samples belong to in the new partition belong to the same class, n becomes a leaf. For example, again, within H, the age group 31 to 30, it seems like everybody was in class yes, and therefore we created a leaf node. If we are not belonging to the same class, however, we do not have any attributes to work with, because every attribute, depending on the attribute selection method, might only be able to become a node for once. There are some attribute selection methods that do not allow attributes to become multiple times part. And then we use the majority class as a leaf node. And if the partition D is empty, we create a class with a majority class again for the whole data set. One thing I used very often in my explanation was attribute selection method. Because we have different attribute selection methods, and depending on the attribute selection method, we will get to different outcomes of our tree. These attribute selection methods basically select the attribute that becomes the node, but it also might be able to give us the best partition possible. Basically, it's a ranking method. We do not get only one attribute, but we get H is the best splitting criterion. Then it might be student and credit rating third, and so on. And we naturally most often decide to use the first, the best. The most popular methods in here are information gain, gain ratio, and Gini index. Information gain and gain ratio are pretty closely related. Gini index is out of that scope. However, we will talk about all three of them. Let's start with information gain. With information gain, we are trying to select the attribute with the highest information gain. To understand that, we first have to talk about what is information. Information in this case is basically, so the information we want to have, of course, is the class back here. And the information at all is basically how often are these classes occurring. So basically, we have the formula to try to get to the expected information that we need to classify a tuple. So how much information is needed to predict that class? This is defined as negative, the sum of all probabilities that a tuple D belongs to class C, I, times the second logarithm of this probability. I hope I have an example in here. Yes, I have an example in here. We have to take a look at the left side here, so this formula. So the information, the entropy, the expected entropy for our case class P and class N, so buys computer and doesn't buy computer, is determined as minus 9/14 probability. And this 9/14 comes from here. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 yes, and 14 in total. So 9/14. To the second logarithm of 9/14, the same probability, minus the probability for the second class, so no, where we have 5 no's within 14 tuples, and we end up with an expected information we have to have of 0.94. This is, of course, not the complete information gain. This is just the first step. Because that's just the expected information. To get to the gain an attribute delivers us, so how much less information is needed to get to our class, we have to take a look at the attributes themselves. And there we have to divide, have to take two different paths depending on the type of attribute. One method is used for discrete value attributes, and one is applied for continuous valued attributes. So in this example, discrete valued attributes, continuous valued attributes. Let's go with discrete valued attributes first. If the attribute we are taking a look at has V distinct values, V as a group have to apply this formula down here. We are taking a look at every different kind of value within that attribute. And we divide the total number of values within our data set, or partition. We use the amount of values with that specific attribute within our partition and divide it through the total amount of values within the data set, and use the information, the entropy of that specific data set that contains that attribute value. This is part of this slide as well, so maybe an example helps a lot. We have to take a look at this formula up here. We are taking a look at the attribute age right now. And within age, we have three different possible values. Lower than 30, between 31 and 40, and above 40. For each of these three values, we have to once determine a value within that formula, because we have the sum of all different values. The first part is pretty easy to determine, because we just count how often the specific value is occurring within the attribute, divided through the total amount of values, 5/14 in this case, or 4/14 for, in this case, I think it's the above 40 values, and 5/14 for 31 to 40. The second thing is we have to compute the entropy for that specific sub data set. So let's take a look at just the first part of that formula, which is, of course, talking about the lower or equal than 30 range. If we take a look at these tuples containing an age below 30, we have 1, 2 times no, 3 times no, I will do it here, 1 time yes, 2 times yes. So we have 2 times yes and 3 times no for the age below 30, below equal 30 parts of the classes. And therefore, we have to compute the entropy for a data set containing 2 yes and 3 no's in our result class. There are some confused students in the classroom. Are there any questions regarding that? Okay, the confused students do not want to talk about that. Okay. But basically, we have to, again, use this left formula to compute these separate cases. And if we do that, we end up with the information needed if we select H. And now, the last step is to compute the information gain by taking a look at the expected information of the whole data set minus the information needed for just the attribute age, and we get to an information gain of 0.246. We can do the same for every attribute, and we end up with four different gains, from which the information gain at age is the highest. And therefore, the attribute selection method would recommend age to be the splitting criterion. These computations, of course, are better to understand if you do them yourselves. There is an exercise sheet about that. You will do these computations yourselves for one data set in one of the exercises. I think the exercise next week should be the exercise containing that computation. And then we're just not just computing the gain of one attribute, but of multiple. And something that is not contained within that example in here, but will be contained within the exercise sheet, is also continuous valued attributes, because these computations are all for categorical attributes. For continuous valued attributes, we have to do a different thing, because there might be some things occurring that we do not know yet. To do that, we order values in an increasing order. So basically, 1.71 in this case, 1.73 in this case, and then 2.03. And we calculate all possible midpoints. So in this case, I will use that as my example right now. 1.71, we have 1.73. And we have 2.03. And all possible midpoints are here and here. So we have two possible midpoints. For these midpoints, we have different possible splits. So one split would be below or equal 0.1, and below or equal 1.73 would be our two split points. And for these different split points, we can then do basically the same thing we have done with the discrete values attributes, However, we have just two classes, not two classes, but two categories in this case. If we select the lower split point, this would be one category in our left hand algorithm for categories. And in this case, we just would put them into different categories. And then we just apply the same formula. In this case, we know V would be 2, because we have two categories, and we have to get to a binary split. And we have to evaluate that for every possible split. And then we have a two-step process, where we first determine the best split point within our attribute themselves. So let's say this ends up to be an info of 0.3, and this ends up as an info as 0.4, or again, 0.3 and 0.4. Then we, of course, would select this one as the criterion we use for the attribute, and the 0.4 would be then also the gain for the attribute itself, for the overall attribute selection method. Is that understandable? Because I see some confused eyes again. Okay, and no questions again. We will have a continuous valued attribute within the exercise to make sure that you have understood it. So no worries about that. Basically, once we have that attribute selection method, we can determine the best attribute to select. In our case, it was H with a gain of 0.24. So we would select H as a splitting point. We would then split accordingly. Since it is a categorized attribute, we have three different values. We would end up in a three-way split in information gain. Important, for continuous valid attributes, we always have binary splits. So just the part below our split point and the part below above our split point. For categorized split points and information gain, it's possible to have three-way and even five-way or 16-way splits. And once we have done that split, we also have to put only the tuples that satisfy that criterion into our partition. And we can remove, in this case, our attribute from the list because it's already part, it's all the same, contain the same value, so there wouldn't be a point to select it a second time. The information gain would be zero in that case. In this little partition down here, we see why we have a leaf node in the three slides before, because we have always the same class, so we can end up with yes as a leaf node. Okay, now we talked about information gain, and we can talk about the closely related second attribute selection method, gain ratio. Basically, we have a little problem with information gain, because information gain will be high for attributes with a lot of different values. To be precise, it will be biased towards attributes with a lot of different categorized values. Which ends up in very big splits. Because if we have a value, an attribute with 200 different attribute values, we would end up in a 200-way split. Which might be nice to get a small dev decision tree. However, it might be overfitting, it might end up as overfitting, it might end up as things like that. And therefore, we had a successor for this algorithm, not a successor, an alternative for this method to overcome this problem, where we try to normalize the gain we derived. One thing I didn't mention, and that might confuse in here, is that information gain is most commonly known for being used in ID3, which is in total algorithm implementation for classification, and gain ratio is implemented in C4.5, which is a successor of ID3. And it's using gain ratio instead of information gain in the algorithm itself. The algorithms have some slight tunes, have some specifics in them that are not part of that general algorithm. However, you do not have to know how they are implemented in detail. But they are the most common known algorithms used in implementations. So basically, in this case, we have to first determine the split info for a specific attribute in our partition. There, we then simply apply that formula. I think it should be known how to read that right now. If not, ask me afterwards. But basically, this split info is then used to normalize the gain we got from information gain. So we first have to compute the information gain. Then we have to compute the split info for a specific attribute. And then we use that to normalize our gain. Basically, the higher the more values we have within a certain attribute, the higher split info will get, and therefore it will lower the gain of an attribute with many values. Basically. And again, we will select the value with the highest gain ratio as our splitting attribute. There's one big disadvantage for gain ratio. And that big disadvantage is that the split info might get close to zero. And if we are close to zero and we use split info to divide, we divide gain, our information gain, through split info. If split info is, for example, 0.0001, then of course the resulting gain ratio will get pretty big very fast. And that leads to split info, gain ratio being pretty unstable if that is the case. That's not often the case in the real world, but it might happen, and then information gain would be the better method to use. Okay, these two methods are closely related. We use information gain within the formula of gain ratio. So very obvious that they are closely related to each other. One has a big problem that attributes with a large amount of values are problematic, and one has a problem that it becomes unstable if too close to that. And it's also computational more expensive because we first have to determine the first value and then have to can do the second thing. One totally different approach is a Gini index. it's not related to both of them. The Gini index is basically using a statistical distribution expectation to estimate which attribute is the best. In this case, we have 0 as perfect equality. So all values belong to the same class, which is what we want. And 1 expresses maximal inequality amongst values. Let's think about that, how to explain that the best way. So let's take a look at this graph. In this graph, we have the cumulative income and the cumulative population. In this case, we have 2 Lorentz curves that are displaying how related both classes are. The Gini index would be the area below the different curves. So below the red area would be the Gini index for that curve and so on. Between. This is the formula for Gini index, where we take a look at 1, again, is the perfect value. And then we subtract, again, the sum of different probabilities. And basically, in this case, the probability is that the sample belongs into the class, which is estimated by a very simple formula. Again, we have to divide through, we have to talk about 2 different cases, discrete valued and continuous valued. For discrete valued, it's pretty simple. We take a look at possible subsets. Again, we have to do the same thing we have done with continuous valued attributes, or a similar thing. In this case, we have to do it for discrete valued attributes, because Gini index is always leading to binary splits, not only with continuous valued splits. So, similar thing, I say, because if we have the discrete values A, B, C, those are the discrete values within our data set, okay? Or our attribute. Not data set, our attribute. Then our 2 possibilities are not only A, and BC as the first option, but we and second option A, B, and C, but also a third option AC and B, and also. I think those are all options. But since there's no intrinsic order to these values, we have to combine each of them into packs. And that gets pretty big pretty fast, because we have a lot of possible different distributions, subsets. And for all of them, we then have to compute the Gini index separately for one class and the second class. One class, second class. This is pretty tedious to do, of course, especially if you have a lot of different values. And it ends up with binary trees. That might be a disadvantage, it might be an advantage, because maybe we want only binary decision trees. For continuous valued attributes, it's basically the same as in here, because here we have an intrinsic order to our attributes and we can split in these classes. So that in this case, Gini index and information gain slash gain ratio doesn't divide. Again, we select for the first step, we select the best splitting point within an attribute. This Gini value gets the value of the separate attribute, and then we select the attribute with the best Gini index in a second step. So again, two-step process. You first have to become king of attribute, and then you have to become king of attributes. Again, we will do a sample computation of that in the exercise. There will be a separate task about Gini index to make sure everybody understood how to do that. And since I have an example in here, we can talk about that in a second. Or we can talk about it now. Let's do it for the same data set we had before. There was no space to reprint the table in here, but you can trust me in this case that the values are correct. First, we want to determine the Gini values. For the whole data set, we use 1 minus 9, those are the yes values within the whole data set and divided through the whole count, and the same for the no values, and we end up with 0.459 in this case. Now we can take a look at the specific attributes. In the income, here's the table, we again have 3 different values, so we have 3 different splits, possible splits. One possible split is that we split, or we put medium and low into one bucket, and therefore also high into one bucket. In this case, 10 of the 14 total values, let's check that, are either low or medium. Since there are 4 high values, that seems to be correct. And 4 end up as high. So we use 14 times the Gini index of the dataset 1. Dataset 1 is the partition where only low and medium is present. So we delete all income high attributes from that partition, and we end up with 10 tuples being that new partition. And in this new partition, we can then again determine the Gini index. So 1 minus 7 times it's true in this little partition, and 3 times it's wrong in this little partition. The total amount of values in the partition is 10, and so on. And the same can be done for the second possible partition where we have high as the value of income. And if we calculate that, we get to 0.443, hopefully, which is, and I don't really have to add that, but of course, it's also the Gini index, Gini value for D, income high, because those two are linked together, basically. Medium and low leads to the other class being high. For the other two possible combinations, not only low and medium is possible, but low and high is possible, and medium and high is possible, and then all possible combinations are satisfied, we get to Gini indexes of 0.458 and 0.450. We end up selecting low and medium because it has the lowest Gini index. Now you might ask why the lowest Gini index. This is because of a formula we didn't calculate right now. We can calculate the reduction of impurity in the Gini index. And that's basically using our Gini index for D and subtracting the attribute-specific Gini index from that. And basically, of course, in this case, it will be turned around. The lower the Gini index of a specific attribute, the higher the reduction of impurity is. Since this is fixed for all attributes, we do not have to explicitly calculate that step. And we can simply select the lowest value instead of the highest value because we can skip that step. Hopefully, that's also something we will see in the exercise, or I'm pretty sure we will see it because I designed the task explicitly to do that in the exercise sheets. Okay, again, we have a new attribute selection method. This, of course, only is able to determine binary splits, which is fine, but you should know it once you select it. And it has also a bias towards multi-valued attributes. I guess we will see some about that in the exercises. But what's important within the lecture is to say that all of these three methods have advantages and disadvantages. And therefore, all of them have a reason to exist in this case. And all of them are frequently used in the real world to do that. And depending on that, I guess with Gini index, it's pretty obvious, you will end up with different decision trees. Because this decision tree wouldn't be possible with a Gini index, for example, since only binary splits are possible. Something I should also add is that I said once you have created the first node, you remove the attribute from the list. With Gini index, you wouldn't do that. Because it might, and it will happen, that after the first split of income, there are two different attribute values within the one class, because low and medium end up in the same branch, and therefore the partition contains incomes of low and medium. There's a possibility that we want to split between low and medium incomes in the next step. So in this case, it wouldn't be removed from our selection set, and we would have to check it again. Of course, there are a lot of other attribute selection methods. And therefore also algorithms. We decided to use those three and get into detail on them, but you should know that there are some others. Again, you do not have to know them by heart for the exam, but you should be able to look it up, or at least know names to look them up if you want to know about them. With decision trees, we have a big problem, because decision trees might overfit our dataset, our training dataset. What is overfitting? Overfitting is basically that we are training, or we have a specific training dataset that might contain data or rules that aren't present in all datasets. For example, if we have a training dataset, and let's go with a small dataset, and just for this reason, I would change one of the parsers in here. If that's our whole data training dataset, of course it's too small, but it might happen with bigger data sets as well. What might happen in this case? And maybe I should change that to 1.71 in this case. In this case, it might happen that just degree, or it will happen that just degree is the decision, or the degree program is the decision between parsing and not parsing. So if, in this case, a data science student is part of that, then pars is no, trained on the data set. And if you go with Gini index, CS and IAS are yes as a final class. Of course, that isn't the case in a bigger data set. In a bigger data set, every degree program might pass and might not pass. And that's basically overfitting. Of course, overfitting, this isn't the best thing to do it on a small data set like that. It gets harder to overfit the bigger the training data set gets. However, this basically same thing occurs with bigger data sets sometimes as well. And we want to avoid tracing things within our data set that aren't true for all things. Because in this case, this decision tree would simply decide that this person didn't pass. And that doesn't have to be true in this case, and we want to avoid that. And to avoid that, we can do a very simple thing. We can prune our data set. And not our data set, our tree. And there are two different approaches to avoid that, or to do pruning and avoid overfitting within data sets. One is pre-pruning, where we simply halt the construction early. So we do not go further into our tree at a certain threshold. There are certain measurements to measure the goodness of a certain partition. And if that falls below a threshold, we simply have an additional stopping criterion for our algorithm. And we do not go further into the tree. Problem with that is that it's very difficult to select a good threshold for that. With post-pruning, it's a little bit simpler because the tree is already graded, and now we are just removing branches from the tree. And this then can, and we can create different variants of that removed tree and evaluate that on a training data set or a testing data set rather, to select the best pruned tree, which has a big advantage compared to pre-pruning, because in pre-pruning we would end up with only one tree and we have to go with that. With post-pruning, we end up with different possible trees and we can select the best one. There are some enhancements to a basic decision tree. For example, we can allow for continuous weight attributes, but basically we already talked about that. We have different methods to do that. If we have intervals, we automatically allow things being outside of the values we had before. We have to talk about missing values because it might happen that the degree program of this person isn't known. How do we handle that? An important part is it's not known. We do not know whether a student is CS student, is DS student, is IIS student. We can, of course, simply assume that this is a new type of value. However, if we assume that this is a new student and we have some more question marks, some more missing values, it might happen that all these are data science students and all of them passed, and therefore our original training is false. That's a problem with non-values within our data set. They are unknown. They might be any other value. And that's not as easy to handle as you might think. You can, for example, assign the most common value of an attribute to the data set. Beside the fact that in this data set, there is no most common value. There are two modes in our case, because DS and CS occur one time each. It's, of course, also not a perfect solution, because if we, for example, decide to use DS as a replacement for the question marks, it might lead to a certain DS bias that isn't present in the real data. You can, and that's better, assign the probability to each of the possible values. However, the computations get a lot more difficult with that. One thing you also can do, and I see that more often being done in the real world recently, is to do a classification for the missing values themselves. So we first try to train an algorithm to find the missing values, and then we use that trained thing to train the next thing. However, of course, this is not perfect either, because we can't prove that the values are bad. The best thing you can do is to clean up the data set by talking to experts that know the data. So talk to the students where the degree program is missing, or at least the person who knows what the persons are studying. Also, we can create a new attribute for existing ones that are not often, that are very sparsely represented. You might have some attributes that do not contain a lot of different data, then we can combine them, of course, into one single attribute. The last thing we will talk about today, and I will finish with that, I will go through that quickly, is that, of course, with large databases, these methods will get hard because we have to calculate the times how often each thing is occurring very often, and therefore large data sets with millions of examples are not able to be done with reasonable speed. There are two possible methods to solve that, and they are very quickly explained. That's why I'm doing them right now. One is rainforest, where we try to have the original data, and we have some specific metadata that can be used to train our algorithm. Basically, we have an AVC list, an attribute value class label list, which can be done on the data set. For example, for age, we have age with three different values of age, and we simply save how often each class is occurring with that. That's a very small data set that gets fits into our memory easily. If you do that for every possible attribute, we have every information we need to calculate our attribute selection methods and therefore select the attributes without having access to the whole data set. And therefore, it's helping us being scalable. Of course, if you have partitions, we have to redo the tables, but they are conditionally dependent, so that is easily done. And the second thing is BOAT, which is bootstrapped optimistic algorithm for tree construction. Sounds difficult, is pretty simple. We simply take a look at different subsets of original data set, train a model on these subsets, a model for each subset, and then we combine the different resulting trees back together into one big tree afterwards. Which is bootstrapping, basically. That's why it's called BOAT in this case. We will take a look at bootstrapping in more detail later in this lecture. So next week we will talk about bootstrapping again. And that's basically the end. There are some pictures showing very old programs, but those are just for fun in here. So let's end the lecture here. Again, reminder, you have to register for the exam. You only have until the end of the week to register for the exam. Again, reminder, if you want to get access to the trial exam, to the mock exam, which is very close to the structure of the real exam, not to the questions of the real exam, you have to pass the submissions with a certain percentage. And the first submission will be released in 10 minutes' time from now. Have a nice time, and see you next week.